Silence is command.
Please be seated. We are now on our last case for March, 05AP0731CR, State v. Howell. Representing the defendant Howell is Ellen Hennick, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Ellen Hennick and I represent the petitioner Andre Howell. The issue in this case is whether Andre Howell is entitled to a hearing on his post-conviction motion concerning whether or not he understood party to a crime liability when he pled guilty to first-degree reckless injury as party to a crime. Now, the underlying motion was actually quite specific. That motion alleged that he did not understand party to a crime liability, that he believed that merely being on the scene was sufficient, which it's not under the law, that due to the unusual history of this case, it was particularly easy to get confused. And in fact, in this case, originally, it was not charged as party to a crime. This case went on the assumption and on the theory that my client was the shooter of the victim for quite some time. Eventually, he and his attorney brought in his cousin, Joseph Sharp, who told the district attorney that, in fact, Sharp had been the shooter here. At that point, the state amended the charge to party to a crime. The complaint in this case does not give any guidance on party to a crime, which is a little bit unusual, but it's because of the history. And when they got to the plea, the state never really clearly stated what its theory was as to party to a crime. And I think as a result of that, the court had substantial difficulty in explaining to Mr. Howell what it was he was alleged to have done. Now, the fact that this is first-degree reckless injury, and when you talk about intent as party to a crime to reckless injury, you're already into somewhat confusing territory, may have contributed to the problem as well. What happens is that the court attempts to get the state to say what the theory of the case is. The truth is the state was still basically holding to the theory that my client was the shooter. And so the state never was able to fully articulate what it was that he might have done. And there were several things that came up in the plea that were suggested that maybe, but nobody ever pinned it down. The court suggested he might have assisted somebody by putting the victim in a place where he could be shot by someone else. But that doesn't really fit the facts of this crime as they come out in the sentencing and as alleged, what my client alleges actually happened in the motion. And the motion is quite specific about what he alleges happens. Basically, the underlying crime here is that his sister, April, is seeing the victim, or had just finished seeing the victim. It's not entirely clear whether she's an ex-girlfriend at that point or a girlfriend. The family believed, rightly or wrongly, that Pearson was a threat. Pearson, the victim, was a threat to April. What happens is they know that April is going, apparently, to get back keys and money, and that's alleged in my motion, keys and money. What happens is several family members then go over. My client's position, and he's fairly consistent about this, he says nothing that contradicts it all the way through the plea hearing, nor does he say anything that contradicts it during the sentencing, is that he goes over with his cousin because he is concerned about the safety of his sister, April.
There are two sisters here, right?
Right. There's one
in the
front seat.
Okay. One is the driver.
Right. Kimberly.
Right.
There are two sisters here. Kimberly in the front seat, cousin Joseph in the front seat, my client in the back seat.
Looking for April.
looking for April and the supposedly abusive boyfriend or ex-boyfriend. My client's position has been that he is concerned about April, that he never saw the gun. He has a hearing problem. He's sitting in the back seat and the radio is on. And he says it's possible they discussed a gun, but he didn't hear it. They go there. The first time he sees the gun in his version is when his cousin gets out of the car, lifts up the gun. So what you get at the plea hearing, though, is those facts don't exactly come out till the sentencing and until the post-conviction motion. So the court starts by trying to get the state to state its theory. And it suggests, well, he might have assisted people in putting the victim in a place where he could be shot by somebody else. But that doesn't really fit the facts of what's going on here. He, you know, my client feels that what he's done wrong, and it comes through in the sentencing, is that he's told the family that this boyfriend is abusive. Now, he admits he went over there if he had to confront the victim, but there's a distinct difference between confronting the victim if he's beating up your sister, which is not illegal. It may be stupid, but it's not illegal, and actually going over there to shoot someone.
Well, he went in with someone who had a gun, so he knew that they had the gun before they went in.
My client says he did not see the gun until the cousin gets out of the car and raises the gun. He did not hear if he said there could have been discussion about a gun, but in the back seat with the radio on and a hearing loss, he did not hear it.
Did he ever know there was a gun around?
He admits that when he saw the cousin lift up the gun to shoot, at that point, and the shot was fired, at that point he knew that the gun was around. He has denied knowing it beforehand.
Ms. Hennig, did the Judge Sankovitz, say anything here that would in any way confuse your client? Didn't he at least at one point talk about being there to assist or to aid the shooter?
Yes, there are a couple things that happen. The court attempts to lay out what the elements of the crime are. The court makes an attempt, and if you look at the plea transcript at pages 5 through 6, the court goes into a very long paragraph that first goes through all of the elements of reckless injury, and then says, and the state would have to prove either that you were the person who did all those things, or, and this becomes ambiguous within the context, that you intentionally assisted someone who was doing those things, knowing what they were doing. The problem here is knowing what they were doing. It's not clear exactly what that covers. Knowing that they had a gun, does it cover knowing that they were going to confront the boyfriend? There are times when that might be an adequate explanation. In the circumstances of this case, and I'm not going to fault the trial court because the trial court was trying to scramble on its feet to figure out what exactly was going on here.
Well, Counselor, doesn't it just refer back to the stated elements that the trial court said immediately before that?
It does, but what complicates this is you're talking about criminally reckless conduct. And when you're talking about I assisted recklessness, it's not clear what assisting means. I've got a client who's sitting there and says, well, I did tell them that that April was, and I don't remember whether he told them that April was going there or whether they told him April was going there, but he is aware that the cousin knew that the boyfriend was abusive in part because of statements he had made.
Well, during the plea colloquy, did Judge Sankovitz say anything that would lead your client to believe that just being present was sufficient for being party to the crime?
Well, he talks about on pages 7 and 8, after the court, and if I could go back and say what the state said, because I think the problem here is I think this record needs to be viewed as a whole. And I think part of the problem here is what might have been adequate in a different circumstance becomes inadequate because of what's going on here in part. The state says that the defendant's position would be that his cousin was the shooter and he was there, saw him with the gun as they got out of the car, and would have approached the victim. Now, the victim was already standing there. I'm not sure what approaching the victim or going forward or getting out of the car does in terms of the reckless. It doesn't make it any more likely or less likely that a crime's going to be committed. I guess that's as opposed to yelling out, hey, my cousin's got a gun.
Well,
I mean, that's the problem here, is it doesn't clear that up. And then the court attempts again to try and clear it up and says, you're agreeing that you and your cousin were there, you approached Mr. Pearson, and by doing so you assisted your cousin in shooting him. But I'm still not clear, and I don't think anybody is clear, in part because the state never articulates it, nor does the court. What approached him? Does it mean I was standing there and I was kind of wandering in that direction? That in and of itself isn't sufficient.
Ms. Hennig, the portion of the transcript that you just referred to on pages 107 and 108 of the appendix, starting with Mr. Berg's discussion, Mr. Backus's discussion, and finally that paragraph from the court. I'm sitting here and I'm reading those facts. Exactly what offense do those facts constitute?
Appendix to the state's brief, okay.
Pages 107 and 108, and just the very language you just read, his position and his argument to the court will be that his cousin was the shooter and he was there with him, observed him with the gun as they got out of the car, and would have approached the victim in the situation. Mr. Backus, we would stipulate to the factual basis that those are the facts. Is that a correct? The court. So, Mr. Howell, you're not necessarily agreeing that you went there and you approached Mr. Pearson and by doing so assisted your cousin in shooting him. Now, my question is a very simple. I'm sitting there as a trial judge wrestling for a factual basis to accept a plea. And I hear that.
I don't think.
What am I hearing?
You're hearing basically that my client was on the scene, and you're not really hearing anything more than that. I'm not convinced that that's sufficient. Would have approached only matters if somehow that assists in the crime, and it's not clear to me on the facts, the underlying facts of this, that whether he takes a couple of steps forward or not, if his cousin's getting out of the car and lifting up the gun, and my client comes back to this at the sentencing and says, I couldn't stop him. You know, I didn't make any move to stop him, but I don't think I could have.
Counsel, the fact he, your client, went there with the cousin. They went there to do something, and that was basically to confront him. So there was no question when you say you didn't know what they were. Well, they were in the confrontation was an agreed upon act. Whether there was a gun is what you're trying to raise. Whether he knew someone was going to. Whether he knew that.
Well,
I mean, that's why I raised what.
Right.
Whether they were in the car and music was playing. No. As I understand the facts, that a sister drove Howell and the cousin to, you know, Pearson's location, as I understand the facts.
Right. But in his mind, and he goes through this when you get to the sentencing, in his comments at sentencing, what he's saying he was going to do was to confront, but confront in this case didn't mean beat up. Confront meant to stand there, at least in his mind, and make sure that Pearson, the victim, didn't do anything to April.
Yeah, well,
confront has all sorts of meanings, and that's one of the problems here.
Well, look, the judge says on 105 that the state would be required to show that someone caused great bodily harm to Marcus Pearson. They would have to prove that whoever did this did it by criminally reckless conduct. That means they, not singular, they were engaged in conduct the person knew at the time to create a substantial and unreasonable risk of death or great bodily harm and was aware that they were creating such a risk. Right?
The problem
that it was utter disregard of human life. Those are the elements, are they not, of reckless, whatever the crime
reckless
is, reckless injury.
Right.
All right. So that's what the crime's all about, right?
Right.
And you're saying, right, but he didn't know that he was a party to that crime because he didn't know that he had to have done more than be present. That's your argument in a nutshell.
Right.
So you want to have an evidentiary hearing to show, if I understand what your claim is, you want an evidentiary hearing so that the court can figure out whether his defense that he didn't know that mere presence, what were the facts that day, and whether he understood that mere presence was insufficient. Is that what the hearing, what's the hearing going to say? Have I misstated what the hearing's going to find out?
No, that's exact, the hearing is going to be, he's claiming, we're claiming, and I believe it's true, that Mr. Howell did not understand what he needed to be guilty of in order to be guilty, that based on the facts as they were, he would not have pled had he realized, because he, in fact, was not guilty. And what the hearing will do is it will determine whether, in fact, he understood.
Okay, well,
if he didn't understand, allow him to withdraw the plea. If he did understand, okay, then the plea stands.
And either you or the State are going to bring in his counsel at trial.
Right.
And counsel at trial is going to say that he did or she did or didn't explain what party the crime was, and et cetera.
Right. And interestingly here, I went back to the guilty plea questionnaire, which often would have that kind of information on it. If you look at the guilty plea questionnaire here, we have no idea what counsel explained, because when he sets forth the elements, all he says is, as party to a crime, and then he sets forth the elements of reckless injury.
And that's what you want here.
Right.
And the legal issue, as I understand it, is whether you're entitled on the basis of the affidavits you put in and the motion.
Yes.
Whether you are entitled to such an evidentiary hearing.
Yes, and that is the sole issue.
That's right. And so the saga continues to decide whether this is, I'm just trying to get to the legal issues so we can sort this out. That is this a Bagert hearing?
Right.
If it's a Bagert hearing, then perhaps what he says is that he didn't understand, although conclusory might be satisfactory. So what, to get a Bagert hearing, you have to show on the record there's a, to use a fine technical legal term, a screw-up in the plea colloquy, right?
Correct.
And your screw-up is what?
The screw-up is that the court was unable to articulate sufficiently and determine that he understood party to a crime such that he would understand what he was pleading to.
That's on the record. That's is this a Bentley? I just want to know whether it's Bentley.
I believe it's a Bangert.
You think it's a Bangert? Okay.
I believe, however, that it really doesn't make a difference and shouldn't make a difference.
All right. Why not? Well, first tell us what's the difference between Bentley and Bangert.
Okay. I think the difference between Bentley and Bangert, and Bentley's basically been discussed in this court in terms of ineffectiveness claims. In Bentley, you can have a Bentley claim that says I don't understand. You can have a Bangert claim that says I don't understand. In the Bangert claim, the reason you don't understand, or one of the reasons, in this case there are multiple, but one of the reasons you don't understand is because the court failed to determine that you in fact understood.
Right.
Because the court did not do its job.
Because it's something you meant with the plea colloquy.
Right.
On its face, on the record.
Right.
Okay, what about Bentley?
Now, Bentley usually applies when you have something where you say, I don't understand, and it's for reasons outside the record. What has made this case so difficult in terms of everybody going back and forth about what this is that, in fact, he's saying, I didn't understand for reasons both on the record and off the record.
So do you agree with the State that it's both a Bangert and a Bentley, and that you can have the same, you can have a Bangert and a Bentley in the same case?
Yes. I've come to agree with the State that you can have both of them in the same case. Precisely in the situation that I've got, where you've got some of this understanding coming from outside the record, some of it coming from inside the record.
Mm-hmm. So what facts did you show that are outside the record that entitle you to a Bentley hearing?
Okay. When it comes to the Bentley hearing, he also pointed to the fact that one other source of his misunderstanding was both sort of the history of the case, some of the statements that were made outside of court between him and his attorney, as well as perhaps, and this isn't as well alleged, but there's some reference to it, some of the statements you know, in terms of the prosecutor changing over to what, to this being a party to a crime. All of that that went with it. That, and some of that latter stuff is sort of in the record, outside the record. It just depends on how you want to characterize it. And I think it could be fairly characterized either way. Because usually in Bangert, you're looking at what the court did more so than you're looking at what, for example, the prosecutor may have done. And I think that's one of the things that complicates it here. The reason I think it shouldn't matter is because when you come down to the heart of it, regardless of which way you go in this case, the heart of it is, I didn't understand something I'm required to understand to have a constitutionally valid plea.
Meaning that's the best way you can plead it. I mean, that's the issue, isn't it, that you didn't plead it right?
Well, I guess the issue is that I didn't plead it right. I tend to start with these things with what does the client actually understand, and then move out to why doesn't he understand it. And I think in that sense, I wasn't worrying very much when I drafted it as to whether it was a Bangert, a Bentley, both together. I was starting from he didn't understand it. I was giving, much as you might if this were a civil case and you were doing summary judgment, the facts that underlie it. And I don't think to say that he didn't understand something specifically for these specific reasons can ever be thought of as legally conclusory. And I think when we talk about facts and conclusory language, I think what we're talking about with conclusory language or should be talking about is when you plead the ultimate fact. If I had merely pled, this plea was not knowing and intelligent, that's conclusory. Maybe if I had merely said he didn't understand the plea, I still think it's probably factual, but it's not very well pleaded and it's not sufficiently pleaded. But if I say he didn't understand this specific aspect, and I can also point to here are the sources of his misunderstanding. The truth is, from a constitutional standpoint, it shouldn't matter in terms of whether we need a hearing here, whether those, you know, exactly how I'm pleading what he didn't understand. There is nothing ambiguous about what I'm saying about what he didn't understand, and there's nothing that would make it difficult to hold a hearing on this. Everybody going in knows exactly what I'm saying he didn't understand.
Do you agree with a view that seems to be expressed both in the majority opinion in Howell, the Court of Appeals, second, and in the dissent, that is, that the body of law set forth by this court in Bentley and Bangert and related cases is highly complex and too often counterintuitive, so there's widespread confusion?
Until this case, I didn't believe so. After seeing the decision here, I'm ready to accept that if people can't seem to figure out whether, for example, Hampton applies here, and I believe it does, that perhaps this court was not as clear as this court thought. I believed when I drafted this that it was pretty clear. I've come to believe, watching this case go through the system, that perhaps I was wrong. I mean, the bottom line here is what we're looking at is, do you get a hearing when you say, I don't understand something that's important, I don't understand this specific thing, here are the reasons why I don't understand. The truth is, if this motion isn't enough, I don't think I could draft a motion in any case having to do with understanding that would ever be enough. I don't know how you draft something beyond this that talks about understanding.
How would you suggest that the court clear up whatever confusion is out there?
Write another opinion, I suppose.
Well, we're going to do that. The question is, how do we do it in such a way that we clear up this counterintuitive problem?
I think what you have to do is say, in these cases, regardless of whether you want to call them Bangert or Bentley, where the claim is that a defendant does not understand, the pleading requirement of understanding is exactly the same, and it's exactly what you did in Hampton. And then what you do is you look at the allegations, and basically you say, not is it credible, because I think that's part of what's gotten mixed up here. I think the state is going to, well, do we believe it? And I don't think it's that whether it's credible. I think it's like a prelim, or closer to a summary judgment motion. Is it plausible?
Counsel, I'm just going to go back. We talked about this weapon, which you said he didn't know it was there. Somewhere in this, Howell's counsel say that Howell admitted a role in arranging for the firearm to be present? Wasn't that part of the record?
That's what the attorney said. Howell, in the motion, asserts clearly that he doesn't know where the attorney got that from because he never told the attorney that.
Well, but
now, what we're also aware of is there's an uncle who speaks at sentencing who makes some sort of allegation. I don't know where the attorney got that
from. Well, I guess the point is, once his attorney said that, he couldn't say, no, you're wrong, or I didn't say that to you, or where'd you get that? He said, no, I agree with that. So, in other words, he admitted that in the hearing. So how?
No, he didn't.
What
happens is this all comes up at sentencing.
Yeah. Well,
and counsel says, he says, counsel admitted party to a crime to bringing of a gun to the scene. My client does not, the light has gone on.
Go ahead, finish up.
My client does not say, no, he doesn't. But when my client gets up and speaks, my client, in essence, contradicts it. If you look at pages 18 and 19 of the sentencing transcript, he gives his version. And I think in doing that, his intent is to say, no, that's not what's going on. What happened was what I'm telling you happened right now. And I think it takes a lot for defendants to stand up and yell, no, my counsel is wrong. And I can tell you, I've had clients do that. I'll tell you what happens in court. The judge looks at them very kindly and says, your counsel is speaking. You'll get your turn when it's a sentencing. And that would have been the end of it. So I think he did that. I think he did that when he got his opportunity to speak, if you look at what he's doing closely.
Well, he says, it's not my intention for anyone to be hurt at all. I didn't stop Joseph Sharp. Don't believe I could have, but at the same time, I'm admitting my foolishness. I am admitting to my wrongdoing. I contributed to this taking, place.
What?
I was there at the scene. I think you're talking about.
Right.
I was there at the scene, and like I said, I did not get out of there knowing that he had a gun. Maybe had I not told him, and then he says that. So he's saying he didn't know he had a gun. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying he said, I didn't know there was a gun. He does contradict it. And if he'd given the gun, he would have known there was a gun. He really is saying, no, I didn't know.
But in another place, after the lawyer talks, he says, I agree. The lawyer, the court asks him something, and he doesn't deny.
I mean, you have a lawyer there. He or she speaks for you. And when you say that's correct, that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
That's all.
And I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Hennick. Certainly, Justice Cross.
The Chief Justice read from part of the transcript on page 105 of the appendix.
Okay. Got it.
All right. I was reading from part of the record that I copied, so I don't know. Is it in the appendix, too?
I think she was quoting from the sentencing transcript, which is a different transcript.
I'm quoting from the sentencing transcript.
Earlier.
Oh, earlier. Okay.
This is the plea colloquy.
Okay.
And this is the one where Marcus Pearson, that's typed in bold, and the court is going through the different elements of the offense. And then the court says, the state would have to prove that the person who shot him in circumstances which showed utter disregard for human life. And then the state would have to prove either that you were the person who did all those things, or that you intentionally assisted someone else who was doing those things, knowing what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then on the next page, there is this somewhat ambiguous discussion by Mr. Berg in the middle of page 7.
Mm-hmm.
But at the bottom, the court follows up. So, Mr. Howell, you're not necessarily agreeing that you shot Mr. Pearson, that you are agreeing that you and your cousin went there and that you approach Mr. Pearson, and by doing so, you assisted your cousin in shooting him.
Correct.
Can't one weave together those passages to to get a pretty clear understanding of what Mr. Howell understood?
I don't think so. And the reason that you can't is, first of all, it's not clear as you go through that what you mean by what I've never been able to figure out is how approaching Mr. Pearson, who was there on the corner with April, assisted or didn't assist in shooting him, because nobody here suggests that by even moving towards him, Pearson was on the corner talking with April. The gun comes up and he's shot, and I'm not sure how moving forward, moving backward, or doing any of that ends up assisting him. It merely puts him there. And that's why I think it's very confusing, is because I cannot figure out, in some circumstances, approaching, if you're getting the victim to stay there, if by approaching you freeze the victim on the spot, maybe you're assisting. But under the facts of this, I can't figure out how approaching ever becomes assisting. And I think what happens is everybody's trying to cobble together, and I think that that's part of what confuses Mr. Howell.
Isn't the crux of a Bangert violation that the court was somehow deficient in the plea colloquy, and that's evident from the record?
Yes, and I believe what the court failed to do here was, once the confusion clearly broke out, the court should have gone back and made sure it got cleared up. There are two ways a court can fail, because a court, it isn't that the court is required to tell the client something. It's that the court is required, if you go back to 97108, to determine that the defendant understands. So if you think you've got a yes, kind of understands, and then things get confused, I think the court has an obligation to go back and sort it out. And that's really what the court failed to do here.
So you're not alleging that the court said anything wrong?
Well, I am, but only in a roundabout way. It's what the court didn't say that was wrong. And in a Bangert, often it's what the court doesn't say that causes the problem.
Well, I wasn't going to ask this, but now I have to follow up Justice Brasser's question, because I'm looking at page 5 of the sentencing transcript, appendix 105 of the state's brief. Do you understand that before someone found guilty, can be found guilty, the state would be required to prove on February 8th of this year that someone caused great bodily harm to Marcus Pearson? The state would have to prove that whoever did this did it by criminally reckless conduct. That means that they were engaged. It's very roundabout. He's not talking about whether it's your client or Mr. Sharp who's done the shooting.
Right.
So it's not clear in terms of who has to do what in terms of the basic elements to begin with. And then you come up with the assistance language below. When I look at this, and that's why I came back with the question earlier, it's like, okay, well, what is exactly – I mean, I picture a situation where Justice Wilcox, who is an avid hunter, wants to take me out and teach me a few things because I can't hunt. I've never been hunting in my life. And we're going to go out together. We've had the discussion a little bit earlier today, and we disagreed, at least Justice Wilcox and Justice Crooks disagreed with something. So he wants to go over and talk to Justice Crooks before we go. Now, we're getting ready to go hunting. I know he's got a gun, and I'm going over there with him, and I'm going to walk up to him. And he gets there, and he shoots Justice Crooks. What? That's what this fact situation seems to suggest to me. It's like, don't I have to know more? That's the concern about the factual basis that's concerning me. If we're talking about just knowledge that somebody has a gun, what else do you have to know?
You see,
Justice Wilcox
is
an opportunity. But Justice Wilcox certainly wasn't hunting Justice Crooks.
I can see what's happening.
We hope.
Late Justice Crooks.
This is reckless injury.
But that's the concern I have with this plea colloquy. Is I'm looking for the explanation of the offense and the acceptance of responsibility, and I'm not sure what your client has accepted here.
And I'm not sure either, and I'm not sure the state knew, and I'm not sure that the court knew. And I think one of the
that's
things
that's not relevant is what your client knew.
Right. But it is relevant only to the extent that it's very hard to explain something you don't understand yourself. To that extent, I think it is relevant, but only to that limited extent. But I think that this they, flipping in and out of they, makes this much more confusing. I can't figure out who's supposed to have done what. I really don't think my client could figure out from this who was supposed to have done what. So I think whatever this initial explanation appeared to be, I think the limits of it became obvious as they went through the colloquy. And that's why I'm saying whether you want to say that the problem with the court was not getting this clearer, and I think it was, or whether it was whatever, that maybe under some circumstances this might have been okay, but as things got more confused, the court didn't go back and clarify. And I would also suggest to this court that if you're writing the decision, one of the other things that I think courts really need to be encouraged to do is to not do these paragraph listing of things and say, do you understand? Because they're much more ambiguous. You wouldn't do cross-examination this way because you wouldn't know what the answer meant. And I would also encourage courts to ask more open-ended questions because I think from the court's standpoint, that would solve a lot of this too. If somebody had looked at my client and said, what did you do? I think that we might have been able to clear it up on the spot. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state as respondent. The state would ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals, and I'm going to offer four holdings, if you will, as to how the state would like this court to rule. The first two will address the Bangert aspect of the plea withdrawal motion, and the second two will address the Bentley, or what I've called non-Bangert aspect of the motion.
Why do you call it non-Banger rather than Bentley?
Well, Bentley was specifically addressing ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And okay. I think there may be situations, and I think either in Brown perhaps or in Hampton, this court recognized that there could be situations that would go beyond just ineffective counsel. I think non-Banger explains simply that we're not talking about plea colloquy. We're talking about any kind of extrinsic reason for the plea withdrawal. With respect to the Bangert aspect of this case, when a defendant pleads guilty or no contest to a charge that includes party to a crime liability, a trial court must undertake a plea colloquy on aiding and abetting or conspiracy as appropriate only in two situations that I can think of. One is where, as in this case, the defendant denies or is unwilling to admit being a direct actor, or raises some other question about party to a crime as during the colloquy. The other is when the state solely relies on party to a crime, aiding and abetting, or conspiracy as the factual basis for the plea. This is likely to occur because oftentimes charges are brought with party to a crime, and the basis on which the state ultimately would like to proceed is direct actor. So in that situation, the need to go into party to a crime may be superfluous if the factual basis that the defendant agrees to has nothing to do with party to a crime. In this case, it was necessary, I believe, for the trial court to at least address aiding and abetting because Mr. Howell did deny being the shooter. The second point on this Bangert aspect, then, is how this applies to this case. In this case, the plea colloquy correctly and adequately informed Mr. Howell of his liability as an aider and abettor by repeatedly explaining to him at least three times during the colloquy that he had to intentionally assist in the reckless conduct that culminated in the shooting.
Did he say intentionally?
Intentionally assist was the first reference to this. There are three that I was going to go into shortly, but that is the first one, intentionally assist. And in effect, that he had to actively facilitate what was going to be an armed confrontation. That's the state's theory, that this was meeting the victim while armed, approaching him and saying, give me back my sister's keys and money.
Under asked for, doesn't he have to do more than that? Isn't it conduct undertaken to intentionally aid another in the commission of a crime that yields such assistance. That's what constitutes aiding and abetting?
Absolutely. And I think the crime here that was intended, now the state's original theory was that it was an intent to commit a homicide, that they jointly went in and that not only did the defendant not just be a bystander here, but he was the shooter. But it morphed into after the decision was made to add the party to a crime, after the cousin came forward saying, I shot him. The state then was going to amend to charge party to a crime intentional, first degree, intentional. And the plea then became first degree reckless. But I think even if you put aside those particular crimes, the crime that was being committed here, agreed to be committed, intended to be committed, was a armed confrontation. Pointing a gun at a person is a misdemeanor.
Mr. Howell, in order to be guilty as party to a crime, would have to know, A, that Sharp was going to pull the gun and point it or shoot it at the victim, and B, assist in his efforts to do so, correct?
Correct. I think that as a minimum here is what was necessary, and I think you can debate about whether he knew or didn't know about having a gun. And by the way, according to the preliminary hearing testimony and the complaint, it was a rifle, so it wasn't like a concealed handgun necessarily.
You just said something different. You said he knew that he had a gun. As I understood what you just said in court, it's not enough to know that he has a gun. He has to know that he intends to point or use the gun. Is that correct?
And threaten him with a gun or something to that effect, right. I think that's the genesis of this. That would be the intended crime that then natural probable consequences would be the shooting itself. Although, arguably, even the fact situation that was presented here was that, he could have been the shooter himself. Somebody went up and he was in the car, the victim was in the car, and shot him either once or twice. He had two wounds, either one bullet caused both wounds or two shots. With respect,
I'm sorry. Given information that's presented in regard to this motion, why does the state feel so strongly there should not be an evidentiary hearing?
That's a good question. My original response when I was doing this in the Court of Appeals was not to suggest that this wasn't adequately pleaded. It was more to suggest that the record conclusively showed, based on, in particular, the plea colloquy, that he understood that this was now an after-the-fact retraction of what he acknowledged at the plea hearing, that there was a sufficient discussion not only of what aiding and abetting means intentionally assist, but tying it to his specific conduct. After the Court of Appeals initially wrote a decision and then withdrew that decision, it wasn't perfectly clear to me that there may not also be a problem here with conclusory allegations when we're talking about a non-Bangert motion. And this actually gets into the second last two points on the non-banger. I disagree with the defendant to this extent with respect to pleading a non-banger motion. That is, that unlike a banger motion, when you're going to say you didn't understand something for extrinsic reasons where you've got a valid plea colloquy, you've got to do more than just say, I didn't understand this, because the plea colloquy suggests that you did. So in that circumstance, and I think this Court's opinion in Brown suggested as much, that, bless you, when you're talking about a non-Bangert motion where you're saying, I didn't understand something that I needed to understand for a knowing and voluntary plea because of something outside the plea hearing record, you've got to identify what that is and how that caused you or what caused you to misunderstand. And I think the real tricky part of this case, in part, is that because you had an adequate plea colloquy here, the defendant coming into the plea colloquy, even if you accept as true that his attorney said, just being there, you're guilty, or not trying to stop the shooting, you're guilty, once he got into the plea colloquy and the trial court told him about intentionally assisting, told him about the facts that had to apply to this case, the defendant couldn't have been misled any further to not understand what his liability was as an aider and abettor. That's the gist of the state's case.
So your argument would be that as to the non-banger aspects of this motion, that the statements made are really conclusory? Is that the approach?
Right. With respect to the non-banger, there's actually a two-part, if you will, deficiency or reason why it should be not denied without a hearing, the non-banger claim. One is that it was not adequately pleaded in two respects. One is that he didn't spell out what it was that his counsel said to him that could have caused him to not understand aiding and abetting. In other words, he said something to the effect that his counsel led him to believe that just being there and not acting to try to stop it was enough. Now, this may be splitting hairs a little bit on that particular point. I grant it that he could have said, well, my counsel specifically told me that, instead of saying led me to believe. And maybe that's not as compelling an argument. But the second aspect of the pleading deficiency is he doesn't explain, even if he believed that going into the hearing because of what the discussion with counsel was, he doesn't explain in his motion why, after the hearing disabused him of that or told him accurately what it was about, why now he's coming back and saying that he didn't understand. He doesn't adequately plead that aspect of it. And for a non-banger motion, the state's position is that you need more information to do that. The third aspect of why the non-banger motion fails is that the record as a whole, not just the plea colloquy, but the sentencing comments where it gets more specific about the gun, also supports that the defendant fully understood why he was being charged, why he was pleading guilty, and that is he was confronting his sister's ex-boyfriend in an armed confrontation with another man, and that ended up resulting in the shooting. With respect to the adequacy of the plea colloquy, because I think that's probably the best, if you will, best part of this record from the state's perspective as far as informing the defendant. Three quotes from that colloquy from the trial court. Looking at pages 102 and 103 of the appendix. The trial court told Mr. Howell that he was guilty if, quote, he assisted people in putting the victim, Pearson, in a place where he could be shot by somebody else. That's the party to a crime. In other words,
how did he do that?
How did he assist him?
Yeah.
It's not clear from the record how they knew he was going to be in his car at this particular location. The presumption is that they found him there because they had arranged for him to be there, but the record doesn't expand on that. The second aspect of the colloquy.
So this is what the judge says?
That quoted part is what the court tells him, yes.
Yeah. Well, does the judge know something we don't know?
I don't know. I don't know where that came from. The complaint was...
The complaint was that he was the shooter.
Right. There was not a very extensive complaint. There was a preliminary hearing. I'm trying to think if there was anything from that record that would suggest that. But
the information was amended, wasn't it?
It was amended, correct.
Yes.
There was something
in the information that says that they set him up? That's what you're saying. Assist in putting him in harm's way means
that's right.
Set up. That's
right. And I can't say that I can identify specifically if any of the prior.
And we don't know from this record whether that's true, that he set him up.
Well, he denies that he did, of course, but the state's position is either
he
shot him
or... No, but there's nothing in the record that shows he set him up. There's nothing that said, I called him at 2 and I agreed to meet him at 3.
Evidentiary's allegation, you mean? Or you mean evidence?
Yeah. Anything.
I'm not aware of anything specific.
All right, go ahead.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
Go ahead.
I'm not aware of that. The only thing that it could have been is that in part of this discussion about being amended to party to a crime, in part, what happens later in the colloquy when they're talking factual basis, the prosecutor interjects about you approached him, while knowing that he had a gun and you were armed and you were going to confront him in this armed confrontation. That may have been, the court may have inferred from that that they put him in this position. The second aspect of the colloquy that demonstrates aiding and abetting and annoying understanding of the charge is at pages 105 and 106, and that's been referred to before in the prior argument. That is, the trial court told told Mr. Howell that the state would have to prove that either Mr. Howell himself caused great bodily harm to Mr. Pearson by conduct that he knew created a substantial and unreasonable risk of death or great bodily harm, or that Mr. Howell, and this is the quote, intentionally assisted someone else who was doing those things, that is, putting this causing great bodily harm, knowing they were creating a risk of death or great bodily harm, knowing what they were doing. So it's not the most artful articulation, but it is, I think, an understandable articulation. Mr. Howell is 30 years old. He has some college experience. In fact, if I understand from sentencing, if I recall correctly, he was interested in criminal justice.
You just took the wrong
list.
So that's the second part of the colloquy. And then the third part of the colloquy is where the court goes into the factual basis. And this is pages 107, 108. And at this point, Mr. Howell himself acknowledges in response to the questioning from the court, knowing that when they exited the car, his cousin had a gun. And again, this was a rifle based on the prior information in the record. And that with this knowledge, Howell and his cousin jointly approached the victim, thereby evincing an intent to assist his cousin in the armed confrontation. In other words, they were going to come up to him with a gun and say, we want this stuff back. That's the inference of that.
Are you paraphrasing?
I am paraphrasing that at 107, 108. Yeah. That is not a direct quote.
It says that the direct quote is that you are agreeing that you and your cousin went there and that you approached Mr. Pearson, and by doing so, you assisted your cousin in shooting him. That's the factual basis.
That's correct. That's the factual basis. And one aspect of this, if you look at the jury instruction on aiding and abetting, it's not just assist, but it's being ready and willing to assist. And the actor knows of that willingness.
What is the court's obligation? Let's say this is ambiguous. That you are agreeing that you and your cousin, I mean, your opposing counsel is going to, I mean, does say, of course, that there's nothing in anyone's version of the facts. There was an approaching of, as I understand the argument, you got out of the car and the gun came out. So the factual basis is that you are agreeing that you and your cousin went there, and that you approached Mr. Pearson, and by doing so, you assisted your cousin in shooting him.
Knowing that was going to happen, knowing that this was the plan, so at least not necessarily knowing that he was going to shoot him, but knowing that they were going to confront him with the gun.
Mr. Frame, if you were going to do this now by hindsight, and you can get a lot of time to prepare, et cetera, how would you have given this plea colloquy?
How would I give the plea colloquy?
I mean, we now know what the issue is. Sure. We now know what the defendant is asserting. You know, the judge has to do it quickly and doesn't necessarily know very well before he gets into court what all the issues are going to be.
Sure.
Okay, so what would you...
Well, I think the ideal situation would be Once it became clear that this wasn't going to be a direct actor kind of thing, go to the jury instructions, probably first find out what the state's theory was going to be. And once that was established, that it was aiding and abetting, for example, and not conspiracy, then go to the jury instruction and read that jury instruction. I think it's quoted at
in my brief. Okay, I know it's in one of the briefs. What is that?
Okay, let me just pick it out. Sorry.
Because I want to compare that.
Exactly. And that's what I was hoping to... Sorry, I don't have it at the...
Okay.
At the
that's thing. All right.
It's at page 22.
Okay. Red brief. 22.
Right in the middle is the quote.
Right. So what you would do is assists, is ready and willing to assist in the person who commits a crime. Doesn't aid and abet if it's only a bystander or spectator and does nothing to assist. So the big words are assist.
The last part about bystander, by the way, is not something that the jury instructions suggest should be given in every case. but only where it becomes an issue. And I think part of the problem here was when Mr. Howell accepted what the court was saying about this is what why you're guilty, he didn't raise any question saying that, well, all I was really doing was standing or being there. He never caused the court to have a question about him being merely a bystander, merely somebody who was arguably withdrawing from any kind of confrontation. Neither he nor his counsel suggested, and understandably, if they were intending to plead guilty, nobody suggested that he was an innocent bystander.
Counsel?
And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was thinking about we have to look at what took place. I guess I overlooked the fact that this was a rifle rather than a handgun, that the alleged shooter or the shooter was in the front seat with a rifle.
Correct.
Encased.
The victim, yes.
Yes, yeah. I'm just wondering how there would be a lack of knowledge. You know, we're talking about whether the gun was actually, whether he knew a person had a gun or not.
I'm confusing two things here. The victim who was shot was seated in the front seat of his car. When the defendant and his cousin, the cousin being the alleged shooter, approached him, either the cousin or the defendant shot him with a rifle.
Yes.
Shot through the windshield, I think. I think the preliminary hearing testimony from the victim was that it was at an angle from the front windshield, something like that.
But when did the shooter pick up the rifle? Where was the rifle? Is that in the
record? Well, it's not in the record. It was in. They exited the car, according to the factual basis that was offered or presented by the state, that they exited the car, and that's when the defendant certainly knew that he had a rifle and approached him with the cousin. One of them had the rifle. That's part of the confusion here, is that.
But the way that I'm looking at this factually, and that's why that the cousin was in the front seat and Mr. Howell was in the back seat of a vehicle, and Mr. Howell was supposedly listening to music and couldn't hear what they were saying, but I was imagining having a rifle in the front seat of the car that was, concealed.
There's in the pleading, and it's a little bit ambiguous in the plea withdrawal motion. There's a discussion that he alleges either in the affidavit or the motion that there was a discussion between his cousin and his sister about a gun.
Sure.
But then it says he didn't hear it because of the loud music and he's hard of hearing. So it's a little inconsistent. Either he had to know something about.
If this was a handgun, you're going to secure it, put it in your belt or stick it in your back pocket or wherever. If it's a rifle, you have a little difficulty sticking it someplace or putting it someplace.
Assuming it was a long gun, yes, yeah. I would agree.
We don't know. How big would the short gun be?
It's either a sawed-off shotgun or it's a rifle.
Well, I think at one point, something in the record from the defense standpoint was that the defendant suggested it was a shotgun and that it was shotgun pellets. And the reprise to that was that, no, it was actually 40-caliber bullets that were recovered, so that it wasn't a shotgun. It was, in fact, a rifle. That's all I know about as far as the
not in evidence.
So you mean whether it's a rifle or a handgun is not in
evidence? No. The rifle was a preliminary hearing testimony.
Yeah, so
whether it was a rifle or a shotgun, I mean, there's some dispute, but the testimony of the victim was that it was a rifle.
Is there anything in the record about the rifle being transported in the vehicle?
Other than nothing at the plea hearing, at sentencing is where the defense counsel, and this is where I was going next, actually, for the non-banger aspect of it, when you're looking at the record as a whole, conclusively shows no merit. At sentencing, defense counsel, at three different points in the sentencing record, pages 10 through 12 of the sentencing, and that, I don't know if that's attached. I don't think so. It's document 23. At three points, the defense counsel, quoting him, says, Mr. Howell admitted a role in arranging for that firearm to be present. And another point, counsel says, Mr. Howell was, quote, was involved in getting that firearm there. And another point, counsel says, Mr. Hall admitted to this bringing of a gun to the scene which was fired. So the suggestion, at least from the sentencing transcript, is that Mr. Hall, and Mr. Hall didn't rebut for whatever reason, did not dispute that. For whatever reason, I'm sorry, that is the description of the information, at least about the knowledge of the gun, or the most complete information about the knowledge. Now, Mr. Hall, at sentencing thereafter, admits that he approached the victim and he says, quote, he was aware, quote, that my cousin had a gun. So he admits at sentencing that he knew about this in advance. So that, again, when you're looking, and this would be legally in the context of looking at a non-banger claim where you look at the record as a whole. And before I forget, in my brief, I'm inaccurate when I suggest, and this court in Brown, I missed this, in a Bangert situation, if the defendant makes a prima facie showing, which requires identifying something wrong in the colloquy and saying, I didn't understand that deficiency, gets an evidentiary hearing. You don't look at the record as a whole. The state can't not win on the record as a whole without a hearing. And I suggested in part in my brief that that was the case, and that's mistaken. Where you look at the record as a whole is going to come into play in the non-banger context. And Bentley is, and when we talk about the pleading requirements, Bentley is the seminal case in that area that suggests there has to be a pleading that enables the trial court to meaningfully assess that claim. And with respect to the non-banger claim, that's where, in part, the state's argument focuses, is that without developing exactly what transpired in the alleged discussion with counsel, you could see a hearing taking place where the defendant gets up and says, my counsel led me to believe that just being there was enough. And defense counsel gets up and said, I don't recall saying anything like that. And, I mean, I understand that you can have a credibility dispute, which would require an evidentiary hearing, but without fleshing that out, neither defense counsel or the state really has a fair opportunity to really respond to that without, you know, other than having this exploratory evidentiary hearing as to what may have happened.
Mr. Frommuth, I'm looking at the jury instructions on party to a crime. And I know a lot of times when I used to do sentencing or take guilty pleas as well as sentencing, I'd look at the instructions and often go through the elements as part of the process of taking the plea. When I read the instruction, to intentionally aid and abet first-degree reckless injury, the defendant must know that another person is committing or intends to commit the crime of first-degree intentional homicide or whatever, you fill in the blank, and have the purpose to assist the commission of that crime. However, if the evidence supports it, and at least the question has been raised in this case, a person does not aid and abet if he is only a bystander or spectator and does nothing to assist the commission of a crime. Would this case even be here if the trial court had actually gone through, read through this instruction and advised the defendant accordingly?
Well, certainly he couldn't have claimed that then. He couldn't say, well, I didn't know that being a mere bystander or not, you know, not failing to act to stop. He couldn't have put that in his motion because the plea colloquy would have clearly defeated it. My argument is that it was unnecessary to go into that in more detail here because he gave no indication that he didn't understand the intentionally assist aspect that was being.
But the reason I read the first portion of that instruction is because the trial court never instructed the defendant of that. He never went through and said that Sharp had to have the intention of going through and committing this offense, and you had to intend it to assist in the commission of that offense.
Right.
That was what's missing in this case.
I agree that there was no discussion about the intended crime specifically. And as I suggested earlier, there's two possibilities. One is that the armed confrontation itself is the crime because you're assisting somebody and pointing the gun at them. But the broader scope would have been that they went there with the intent to shoot him, the intentional homicide aspect of it, which was the original charge. And this got, I don't disagree that this got lost a little bit in the translation when we got to the plea hearing, but I still think there was enough information there, especially when you talk to develop, you know, what he specifically did, approach him with a gun.
And that raises the question of, if it got lost a little bit in the plea hearing, as you seem to acknowledge, What is the trial court's responsibility at that point to flesh out the defendant's understanding?
Well, unless the defendant, again, I guess unless the defendant raised some question about that, I don't know that the trial court here necessarily had to identify the specific crime beyond the fact that he was assisting in conduct here that would result in great bodily harm. In other words, that he was assisting in confronting with his armed gun and shooting. It's hard to articulate. You've hit a soft spot, if you will, in the colloquy. But I don't think it's the kind of omission, given everything else that happened here, that made that colloquy inadequate for this defendant to understand.
What difference does it make if the court says you lose on both Bangert and Bentley? That's the end of the case, right? Suppose the court says, well, your Bentley isn't good enough, but your Bangert is. Gets an evidentiary hearing?
Correct.
The evidentiary hearing is going to be the same, regardless of which claim we're under?
It'll focus, if there's a, well, that's a good question. If the complaint is that there's a Bangert violation, and that's established, then the focus is going to be on that specific deficiency.
Well, the focus will be on the deficiency that he didn't understand
in this case,
what aiding and abetting is, and that he was a bystander.
Right.
But that would be the same under the Bentley here.
In this particular case, the same two
but
aspects of it.
In this case, it really doesn't matter whether they say he's Bangert. As long as you say that there was a deficiency in one of them,
right,
gets an evidentiary hearing, and it looks to me like it's the same kind.
Right. As a practical matter,
the
I think.
The burden of proof is different.
That's the other aspect. I'm sorry. Thank you.
I agree with that. In Bangert, the burden of proof is on the state. In Bentley, it's on the defense.
And that is a key difference. Thanks for catching and informing. That when you're talking about a non-Bangert or a Bentley type claim, that's why there's a difference in pleading as well, because when you're talking about that type of claim outside the record, you've got to articulate exactly what it is that caused that misunderstanding, because it's not the plea colloquy.
Got it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Primus. Ms. Hennick?
I'd like to go back for a moment to this concept of what it was that needed to be understood. What the state basically has told you, and while I might dispute it, let's go with what the state said, that my client had to know that he would have the gun and had to know that he would point or use the gun. If you go through these transcripts, there is nothing that tells my client that. There is nothing that says. The truth is the gun never really comes up in the plea except that the other person had the gun and was going to shoot it and you somehow assisted. There's none of this. You knew he would point it. And that's exactly the weakness in this. There's nothing in there that says that you knew that he would point this.
Well, would you carry a gun to meet somebody with an understanding between parties that you were just kind of carrying it along?
But the question then becomes, when did my client see it? And it
well,
does
if it's
matter.
A rifle, if it's a rifle and they got out of the car, he had to see it instantly when they got out of the car. The guy couldn't have had it in his pocket or down by his side.
And I agree with that. But then the question becomes, what happens at that point? And as I said to you, what you've got, and if you look at the preliminary hearing transcript, and I would suggest to you that I would ask you to look at the transcripts here. And sometimes it doesn't matter, but I think how these get paraphrased does matter. I think this Court really, in this case, needs to look at the language of what's going on. If you look at the preliminary hearing, there's nothing – the victim is saying, and he's the only one who testifies, that my client shot him. So we're starting from that. There's nothing about – he's sitting in a car talking to – and he phrases it as another female that happens to be Sister April.
Kimberly.
Nothing that suggests that he would have gotten out, moved, or anything else. You don't have to put him in the position. Approaching makes no difference. He's already right there. And that's the problem here. He's already right there. Approaching has nothing to do with it. Approaching, not approaching. Once that gun comes out, if Joseph is going to shoot, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion.
Was your client in the car when the shooting was done? In the car?
Well, there are two cars. There's the victim's car, which he's not in. What happens is, at his house, Joseph, who's in the front seat, April, who's in the front seat, pull up. Now, my client never said there was a conversation about a gun. What I was trying to do was to cover, well, maybe they were talking about the gun because I knew my client had a hearing loss. He doesn't say there was a conversation about a gun. He says if there had been, I wouldn't have heard it, and here's why. He's not admitting that there was one. I don't think he knows whether there was one. He then gets into the back seat. My understanding of what happened, and it may not be pled that well, is they pull up, the door pretty much opens, he gets in. Should he have seen a rifle? Maybe. Did he see a rifle? He says he did not. If that's a crucial fact, if you get to a hearing, you could maybe argue about that. But he says he doesn't see it until they get out of the car. There is nothing in the plea colloquy that has him saying that. There is nothing in the sentence.
Was the victim shot, Gerson shot, as they were standing next to the car with the car door open? I thought they walked over to his car.
Going back to the preliminary hearing transcript, and I can give you page numbers, but what I've got is a paraphrase here. If you go back to the preliminary hearing transcript, what the victim testifies is he was in his own car and was shot by Dre, which is his nickname for my client. He then says he'd been shot from about 10 yards away, but what he indicates in the courtroom is actually 35 feet away. So I don't know what's going on with distances here. There's some ambiguity as to distances. And he claims my client used a rifle. That's what the claim was, that while he was sitting in the car, used a rifle from either 10 feet or 35 feet away. There is nothing in the record that says where the car that my client was in pulled up to. I don't know how far that was away. These details aren't in there, unfortunately. They're never covered. Now, as for the amending of the charges, in fact, the State was ready to, it's not because my client's talking about party to a crime that the State starts talking about first-degree intentional homicide. That actually happens earlier. That happens before that ever comes up. So I don't think that that was related in any way to the first-degree reckless here. Now, as for why counsel says what counsel says in arranging for a firearm, actually what struck me is something else. If my client's been saying that all along, and the court's having some trouble developing what it is my client did, the truth is it's kind of interesting that nobody says it at that point, which makes me wonder a little bit more even about where counsel is getting this he gave him the gun from.
Counsel, see, this is confusing to me because I'm reading what Howell told the trial court. This is on page 29, red brief.
Which brief?
Red
brief. By the grace of God, this is what, and I just hope that, like I say, I understood that my actions made me guilty by, for one, I did not even get out of the area knowing that my cousin had a gun.
But at what point? He never says at what point. And I think what he's saying is, when I saw the gun come up, I didn't skedaddle. Thank you very much. Once again, I do urge you to read the transcript for yourself because I think it matters here.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hennick. Thank you very much, Mr. Freimuth, for a different, thankfully, standard argument. We are adjourned until our April sitting, which I think is April 11th. The court will meet in conference at 3:15.